So I'm Chris Hecker, and Elizabeth just left, so I can't thank her. But and I wanted to thank Elizabeth, who's not standing here, for inviting me to talk. And so I'm going to talk about design, games, and game design with kind of using the game I'm working on, which is called Spy Party, as a lens for some of these things. Talking about things in general in the game industry, and then talking about Spy Party in specific, and back and forth. And it kind of rambles all over the place. I'm not exactly sure. Is anyone here a professional in the game industry? Okay, and then who's a student? All right, and who like saw it on Twitter and just decided to come? Okay, all right. So it's a big mix of people, and so it's a big mix of a talk as well. So I'm actually going to start at the lowest level, talking about my game for a second. So what is Spy Party? How many of you people here actually heard of the game Spy Party? It's a game in development. Okay, so basically like. If you're familiar with video games right now, there she is. Thank you for inviting me. if you're familiar with video games right now, especially the different genres of games, and like you have a console or a PC or even an iPhone or whatever. If you're familiar with spy games, especially most spy games have a lot of this in them, which is Roger Moore ski jumping away from an explosion in one of the Bond films. And I was interested in making a game that was less about this aspect of spy fiction, and more about this, which is Sean Connery being cool with a snifter of cognac. And if you think about it, the movies about spies, whether it's a Bond film Bond has been getting more and more action, but in general, as a whole, the work, most of it's about the Sean Connery being cool, or the character being cool, seducing people, sneaking around at a party, that kind of thing. And there's just a little bit of action, enough, depending on the year and the, taste of culture at the time, there's more and less action. But like, there's blowing things up in car chases and whatnot. It wouldn't be a Bond movie without that. But there's just a lot of him walking around being cool. Whereas in games, it's all the blowing stuff up in car chases. Like, we don't have any games about the acting being cool part. There are occasionally stealth missions in some games. Rarely do you actually interact with another person in any meaningful way. And so I wanted to get away from the, and I think spies are really cool. Spies are an interesting kind of fictional framework to hang a bunch of interesting social human research off of. Like they're silly, so it lowers your expectations in terms of like believability. There's not really a big uncanny valley in behavior in a spy film. Gadgets are commonplace. But it allows you, but the actual act of spying puts this immediate tension on the problem. Like, someone's trying to get away with something, someone's trying to stop it, that sort of thing. And so it's an interesting space to play. So here's my game. Here's half of my game, at least. So one person plays the spy at a high society cocktail party. Now, this doesn't look like a high society cocktail party. It looks really ugly, and all this art is temporary. But so this will all be replaced. But right now I'm focusing completely on the game design and not on the aesthetics. So imagine a Casino Royale-esque, cocktail party. All the usual suspects are there, the James Bond guy and the ingenue and the slip dress and the, like, Miss Marple Dowager character and the banker guy from Texas and whatever, all the guys, the Banana Republic general, all these people. And they're all acting in character and doing party things, going around, flirting with each other, having drinks, looking at the artwork, looking at the books, whatever, looking out the window at the governor's mansion or whatever. The spy chooses one of these characters and impersonates a normal partygoer while also trying to accomplish missions. And these missions are straight spy tropes, like bug the ambassador, or poison the general's drink, or seduce the ingenue, or things like that, right? So while the spy is trying to act normal like they're at a party, they're also trying to get near the ambassador enough to bug them without someone seeing. And the person who's going to be seeing is this person, the other side, the other player. It's a two-player game, and we're going to demo it here in 1 second. The other player is playing the sniper. This person's looking in from outside the party and is trying to figure out which person is the spy. And they have one bullet, and shooting the bullet ends the game. So there's actually, it's interesting because there's not actually any violence in the game proper. Interactivity has no violence associated with it. It's kind of the threat of violence. It's kind of more filmic use of violence than most games, which is like unlimited ammo. So I thought, since games are about interactivity, watching a bunch of PowerPoint slides about a game is kind of boring. So now we're going to have two gentlemen come up and play the game. And so now the person who's on that computer has to not look sideways, because it's going to be a very easy...
Oh. Well done.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. Okay. So obviously, it's a Turing test, sort of. Who's familiar? Is everyone familiar with the Turing test? Who's not familiar with the Turing test? All right. So Turing was Alan Turing was a computer scientist in the 20th century, one of the fathers of computer science, and he devised this test of whether AI had kind of made it. If the goal of AI is to emulate a human, if you're yeah, well, so it gets a little more subtle because there's like six or eight different Turing tests. But the popular notion of the Turing test is you can do an IM chat with someone. If you can't tell whether it's a human or a computer, then the computer, if it's a computer, it has passed the Turing test, right? So spy party is obviously an inverse Turing test, which is meaning instead of the computer trying to act like a human, the human is trying to act like a computer. And this is actually one of my normal bag of tricks, which I did on Spore actually a bunch. Which is where if there's any place where computers suck, just put a human in the loop there. And so the trick becomes instead of trying to get computers to do something that's basically totally impossible, because we're not going to have a computer that passes the Turing test for 50 or 100 years if we ever do, try and figure out how to force multiply the human so that it doesn't cost. It's not so expensive to have a human in the loop. And so Spy Party actually kind of takes another twist on that, which is that. By forcing the human to act like a computer, you actually get gameplay out of it. It's actually interesting. It's an interesting task to try and act like a computer, which you can find out for yourselves if we playtest later. So now I'm going to take a step back onto the kind of general, like, since this is a general design lecture series for a moment, and talk about how you make things. And I think that, like, basically, how you make things is the same for all the things you might want to make, we all know the kind of algorithm. You design something, and then you build it, and then you test it, and then, of course, you iterate, because it's not going to work the first time, right? But I think as you get more and more experience building very complicated systems, you find that this is basically fractal all the way down. And, in fact, the difference between designing and building actually starts to disappear, both because a design without building it is almost worthless. A piece of paper with a design on it, it has almost zero value at this point in the real world. But also, when you're building something, you're making hundreds of tiny decisions every minute about things that actually impact the design. That's where the rubber hits the road. For example, in a video game, programming is where the rubber hits the road. So just that coefficient you put on how springy the thing is vastly, markedly impacts how the game feels. So really there isn't that much of a difference between designing and building, or you shouldn't differentiate them that much. And in fact, places that enforce a differentiation between those two roles produce lower quality products. I'm going to talk about testing a lot more, but as one more point on this design versus build thing, the company that makes these games does not hire single discipline designers at all. If you do not have a production skill, you cannot work at Valve. Meaning if you're not an artist or a programmer or a musician or something like that, if you're just a designer, because everyone there is a designer, because they realize that that there are so many design decisions at every level that you need to be able to do multiple things at the same, you need to be able to be building at the same time you're designing. So on the testing front, testing is, playtesting is a huge part of my process. As you can see, I tend to test things all the time, even in the middle of a lecture. So, hey, a crash. I hadn't seen that crash before. I'll analyze that later when we get home. It seems like there are probably a million kinds of user testing and a million kinds of testing in general, but three of the most important kinds, I think, are the most talked about are what I call depth testing. So these are my friends Paul and Ian. They're my most important depth-based testers for Spy Party. They've both played Spy Party probably about 11 hours each. They've specialized out to Sniper and Spy. Paul in the foreground plays a Spy most of the time. Ian plays a Sniper. And I basically write the game for them. And I'll talk more about that depth-first approach later. They're the people, they're the audience I'm making the game for right now. Then there's Kleenex testing. Which the name Kleenex testing comes from, you know, you use it once and throw it away. This is what most people think of when they think of user testing, like user experience style user testing, split testing, that kind of thing. Basically, you bring someone in, you sit them down in front of your product, you watch them flail endlessly because your product sucks, you get really embarrassed, but you keep your mouth shut, and then they go away and you take a bunch of notes and then you go fix it, right? And that's incredibly valuable, but it's very different from depth-based testing. Kleenex testing will never get you to the deep, do I have a deep emotional compelling core to whatever the experience I'm trying to make is. Kleenex testing for a book would be the equivalent of you have someone read the first three, have a new person read the first three pages of your book every day. right? You're going to have a great, highly polished first three pages, but you have no idea whether it leads to something deeper. So you have to do depth-based testing. In fact, all of my testing is depth-based testing right now, for the most part. At trade shows, at like PAX and things like this, I do what you just saw here, which is people playing at once each. And I learn a ton of stuff there, but as I'm going to talk about later, I focus almost all of my energies on the depth-based results. And then the final kind of testing that people talk about a lot is focus testing or focus group testing. And please promise me you will never do this. Because focus testing is basically you get a group of people in a room and you have them possibly play your game or whatever, and then you have them talk about what they liked and what they didn't like, what they think you should change, what you shouldn't. And the truth of the matter is all the data shows that people actually don't know what they like and they can't verbalize it, right? And you will also get a laundry list of last year's cool thing, right, that everyone could agree on. So don't bother focus testing. Have a passion and an idea of what you want to make. User test, depth and Kleenex test the shit out of it, but don't bother focus testing because it's not only a waste of time, but it's also a net negative. You'll end up with less interesting stuff. All right, which brings me to an aspect of testing that I wanted to talk about really briefly. On the user testing end of things, because everything's hooked up to a computer nowadays, we're really fond of metrics, right? And so, which has brought about this thing I've started to call metrics fetishism. So metrics are obviously, you know, you can, you know, in the video game world, you can hook your game up to a database in the back end, gather telemetry, metrics, data about how someone's playing it, and then use that to make interesting, intelligent decisions based on how people actually play your game, right? And that's great. the problem is people have started using it to make decisions about directions to go, and that's where it gets really difficult or dangerous. In mathematics, there's this concept of of nonlinear optimization. So if I've got this function here, it's got these two hills in it, and I want to find the highest point, what's called the global maximum, right? Well, the obvious algorithm is you start going uphill, right? The problem is if you start out going uphill on the small hill, you will get to the top of the small hill and every direction will be downhill from there, right? And so hill climbing, which is what the mathematical phrase term is for it, will get you to a local maximum, but will not get you to a global maximum in general, right? And so advanced nonlinear optimization algorithms, like say simulated annealing, have to have a phase which has a more random phase, and they bop back and forth between the two. And there's some complicated math about how they decide to do that. But there's this kind of concept of just a random jump into space. Now we can actually obviously see trivially in this 2D function where the global maximum is, but it's not that simple when you're actually handed a piece of data or a function and trying to optimize it. You can't actually visualize it in that same way. The computer can't see it this way. You have to jump around, hill climb for a little. Bit, jump around some more, hill climb for a little bit until you're confident that you're finding within some error bar the global maximum. And if you think about this, this speaks to the metrics thing because it gets to this question of intuition versus data, right? Do I use my intuition to design something or do I use the data? And it used to be in the game industry that, especially in the game industry, that it was all intuition based. It was basically like, okay, what do I think the cool thing to do here is? I'm going to make that. Maybe I'll play test it a little bit, but I'm the game designer and I'm going to make this game, right? And hopefully it's cool. And, the games were relatively unbalanced. The games, you had to play test a lot. Is this part of the level too hard? We didn't visualize where people were dying in the maps that much, this section is really easy for me because I made the game, but it's not easy for players. It's hard to find that stuff out by sheer intuition. However, I think the pendulum has swung really far on the other side now, and now we're very data focused, very metrics focused. This is especially true. There are game companies in existence that will remain unnamed right now that will not allow design changes that decrease certain metrics. Right? And the problem is that is the basic definition of hill climbing. If this one number has to go up all the time before I'll do anything, you will get to local maxima and never get to a global maximum. So this is actually an old argument, and it's really the art versus craft argument. And the truth of the matter is versus is the wrong way to think about all of these things. To be successful in this kind of area, you want to do both. Just like simulated annealing bobs back and forth between the randomization heat phase and the hill climbing phase when things are cooling, you want to use art and craft. You can't replace all intuition with data. It doesn't work. You will end up measuring things that are easy to measure and then optimizing those variables. At the same time, doing intuition without any data whatsoever is just foolish when you've got access to all these amazing network databases. So that's kind of my rant on metrics fetishism. I've got an article online if you care for more of that flavor of rant. But this is starting to worry me, and it speaks to the design problem in games specifically, but I think in general too. Like, we're kind of a little bit metrics happy these days, and I think the pendulum needs to swing back into the middle. Alright, so back to Spy Party. How should one design games? And the truth of the matter is, I have no idea, and neither does anybody else, and that's my lecture. Thank you very much. Not really, but if you want to design a game like this, we have some idea about how to make this game, right? We still struggle to make even a game like this. I mean, it's amazing graphics. Gameplay is a relatively well understood problem in games like this. Even then, it's still a huge production problem. But it's not a production problem that really interests me that much. Like, that's part of the reason I'm not in the mainstream industry, is because I don't care about trying to make this game more efficiently or more cost effectively or make it more profitable. Every time you're making a game like this and you're trying to add something new, all hell breaks loose, because doing new stuff is really hard, and that's the part we have no idea about. And especially, we have no idea about how to make a game that kind of gets us into what I call this pantheon of art and entertainment forms like that are represented here. Games, I think, have the potential to be peers with these other forms, but are not yet. Now, some people say that we will never actually be here, and I think that's a relatively pessimistic thing, because if you look at the history of art forms that, say, Ebert himself likes, they started pretty basic. This is Fred Ott Sneeze in 1894, one of the Edison films. This actually happens to be the first copyrighted film in America. Fred sticks some tobacco up his nose and sneezes. And this is the entire film, by the way. This gif, that's not like, this is like the intro to the film, and then, like, you know, Fred goes on an adventure. Like, this is Fred Ott Sneeze. Now, I don't actually think we're in 1894, equivalently speaking. I tend to make equivalents to other art forms just because it's hard to know. Like, it's interesting, not because I want to be in film or want to write books or do music, but because these art forms let us kind of see how art forms evolve, right? Especially film and comic books, which started up during written history. Like, literature, music, those are very, very old art forms. It's really hard to see how they kind of, quote-unquote, matured. But with film, you can actually see exactly how it worked. And now, I don't think games are going to travel in exactly the same path, but it's interesting. So I actually claim that we're about 1905 in film, which, if you know any film history, two important films from 1905, The Misadventure of a French Gentleman Without Pants on the Zandvoort Beach, which basically, that title is the script of the film. The water comes in, takes his pants away, he gets arrested, end of movie. Another big film in 1905 was not The Great Train Robbery, which was done in 1903, but The Great Train Robbery 2, The Little Train Robbery. Edwin S. Porter made The Great Train Robbery, obviously a seminal film early on in 1903, made The Little Train Robbery, where he replaced all the guys with kids and the bandits were coming to steal the dolls and candy. This is, I think, the level of kind of a cultural discourse we're at in the game industry is about at this level. We are not, I don't think we need to be looking for our Casablanca or our Citizen Kane. I think we need to be looking for, in a while, we need to be looking for our Birth of a Nation, which is, Birth of a Nation is kind of recognized as, it did not break any new ground itself necessarily, but it was the first film that came together as a modern film, took all of the things like cross-cutting, editing out of sequence, all of these things that they had to develop in film, kind of came together in about 1915. And we're still trying to figure out what those things are, in my opinion. I mean, this 1905 from, you know, the Lumiere brothers were like 1893 or 1894. So it was only 10 years for them, and it's been 30 already for us, but I think it's going to be even longer. So there's some time dilation, because I think interactivity is simply a harder problem than linear media. So it's going to take a while. But if you look at current games, like, there is some hope. Just like in The Great Train Robbery, and even in Fred Ott Sneeze, there's a certain magic to seeing some guy sneeze on screen when you've never seen anything like that before. You can see the seeds of things that actually will matter to people later happening. Obviously, The Sims is about normal people doing totally mundane and normal things, and that's a beautiful thing. So is Seinfeld, so is Friends. This is Eco, which is a Japanese game from 2001, two generations ago, basically. The interesting thing about this, if you haven't seen the game, is the gameplay in the large is basically a totally generic puzzle platformer. You're in a castle and you got to get out. There's bad guys, but that cut, that sequence where the princess and you're holding her hand and calling her and helping her up is completely interactive. It's not a cut scene. So the actual hand-holding mechanic, the calling to her mechanic, the fact that you need her around to help you is part of the interactivity. And so to me, that's a huge stepping stone towards the future of where I think we need to go, because we need to double down on the interactivity. This stuff cannot happen. The stuff that's going to get us into that pantheon cannot happen via cutscenes, because then we're just crappy movies. But but Eco shows that it's not that hard to actually have pieces of that in the interactivity. And so so this is a real inspirational game for me. When I say interactivity, I mean a very basic kind of procedural definition. Basically, like, there is an algorithm and a player, right? I mean, there might be multiple players, it might be network, but who cares? For the standpoint of there is a computer and a player, and the player gives input, the computer grinds on the input, presents output, which then the player grinds on in his head, his or her head, does new input, and it loops, right? And so it's feeding back, it's a feedback system between the computer and the player. Yeah. No, exactly, and I think that the thing I talk about a lot in lectures is this kind of human scale level interaction. And the thing that's beautiful about Eco is it's just this, and The Sims to a large extent as well, is it's just this human level thing. It's not saving the world. In Eco you actually were saving the world, which is why like the larger scale game is like, yeah, whatever. But like that little moment of like just calling to her and she comes and you hold her hand, which is the stuff that's represented in this, is just magic, and it's something that's completely interactive. Like, I do think it's actually the interactivity there. Like, if it was just happening in cutscenes, like, you can go play Uncharted 2, and there's times where you have to help the person, but it's, like, so non-interactive, it doesn't really speak to you. Whereas here, it's like, oh, you know, she's helpless. And the funny thing is, from a technical standpoint, I played this video at GDC during a lecture, and from a technical standpoint, it's very bad technology. Like, their IK solver is horrible and all these things, but it doesn't matter, because they decided to spend it on trying to, you know, make you have a relationship with this girl, as opposed to, you know, aiming your gun correctly or whatever. And so, yeah, that human scale thing, I think, is incredibly important to that. Okay, now really actually back to my game. So on that front, I have a set of aesthetic goals that I want for my game, right? And I'm not trying to at all claim that my game is going to get us into that pantheon or anything. It's like baby steps, right? So I'm going to try and like chip away at the rock, and everyone else should too. And so the kind of aesthetic goals that I'm doing are different from aesthetic goals of most other games, and that's great, and everyone should try for different goals. So some of the things you saw, perception on the sniper's standpoint versus deception and performance on the spy's standpoint, these are things that are not very commonly explored in games. Using your attention as a resource, like you could see when the sniper is playing the game, they have to decide when they're going to focus on someone versus another person. And that is a tense moment, but it's very subtle level. It's like, oh, I'm pretty sure it's that person, but I don't want to, like, I mean, if I'm focused completely on that person, I'm not watching the rest of the party. A lot of games use things like bullets, ammunition, fuel as resource, and here I'm using the player's own attention as a resource that they're having to manage, which I think is interesting. This one is actually kind of important for the world, I think, these days, is this idea of making consequential decisions with partial information. There's kind of this like fantasy that we can actually know things in a concrete way, and that's rarely true for anything systemic and complex and large. But yet we still have to make decisions, and so this game, while it's not about solving the Palestinian conflict or anything like that, a goal would be if people who come away from playing this game start to kind of like think about themselves and how they make decisions with partial information, like consequential decisions, like how that process happens within them. Frank Lance has this great talk about games where he talks about how games are thought made visible to itself. So like it allows you to like have this kind of idea, like consequential decisions with partial information, and kind of put it out on the table and kind of examine it as a thing that's not just in your head. And so I find that really fascinating. Deduction versus intuition. This is a really important thing, and I think another facet of that partial information, know what's knowable, what's not, when you decide, when you spend the time to completely do deductive reasoning on something versus when you use your intuition. Similar, like kind of the snarky version of this is like analysis paralysis versus extinct by instinct. Like, you know, the idea that like when you're the sniper and you're presented with all this information, you have to sort of start to sort through it and how you make that process. And finally, the game is extremely asymmetric, which is pretty rare in the video game industry, actually. Most games are relatively symmetric. There are games like Left 4 Dead or StarCraft which start out as a relatively symmetric core mechanic and then branch off using tuning variables and things like that. This game is far more extreme than that. Like, the two worlds are basically completely different games, yet they're still playing in the same space and still interacting in a meaningful way. So I find that really interesting as a designer as well. So even though I said nobody knows how to design games, and I do actually stand by that, there is a kind of like meta design methodology that I'm following that I found fairly useful so far, knock on wood. And that is what Rob Pardo, who's the VP of game design of Blizzard, who's made games you may have heard of, like WoW, World of Warcraft, and whatnot, calls depth first, accessibility later. And this is why there is a four-page instruction manual that you're required to use to play my game. This is the too long didn't read page of my four-page instruction manual. Because I'm just focusing on making that incredibly deep core first. He talked about this in a lecture in 2006, I believe, at the Austin Game Developers Conference, and it got republished on Gamasutra, and I was in the middle of Spore at the time, and it really struck a nerve with me, it really struck a chord with me. I felt like, so their idea being, Blizzard tries to basically hit that esports level of replayability, the thing you're willing to spend, you know, hundreds of hours on because it's an amazing sport that you feel like you're getting better at and you're actually like, you know, it's skill-based. They get that core first and then make it accessible later, as opposed to trying to make a very accessible game and then add the depth in once you've got it accessible, which the theory being it doesn't work very well. This lecture hit when I was working on Spore, and it really struck home because in some sense I think a large chunk of Spore was accessibility first, depth never. And that's kind of the criticism of some of the core game modes of the game. Now, if you contrast with the Creature Creator, which I think is in some ways the most magical part of Spore, that actually was developed depth first, accessibility later. When we made the Creature Creator, we had the initial version of the Creature Creator years and years and years ago that was incredibly hard to use. It was not Maya hard to use, but it was very difficult for people to use. But it was able to make amazing creatures, and we could animate them and texture them and all these cool things. A group of people spent a very long time, including cutting features that were too general, too hard for people to understand, making it accessible. So I think that actually worked, is kind of the most amazing part of Spore, and that was actually developed in this way. So in some sense, if I'm going to make an error, I'm going to err on this side of things rather than the other side. My game may end up not as accessible, but it will end up deep or I will die trying. This is people playing, standing in line to play Spy Party at PAX last couple weekends ago, and you can see they're all reading the manual because I don't let them play unless they read the manual. Which, forcing someone to read a four-page manual in line at a trade show is kind of like, in 2011, is a little bit bold. We're going to play test, so I've got a bunch of copies of the manual here for you guys. So mechanically speaking, kind of what gets to this, like where the mechanics are kind of where the rubber hits the road again, where it's the bottom, the base level thing that the game, the systems the game presents to you that you actually end up interacting with. For Spy Party, you're basically a complete focus on player skill. This is the Korean characters for Gosu, which is the which is basically the concept of you're really badass at a game, right? Like you're sort of the god of the game. And the Koreans are incredibly competitive as a culture with video games, StarCraft, Counter-Strike, and these kind of things. So they've come up with all this phraseology for describing players who are, you know, what level of player you are and whatnot. So most games that are about player skill, like take Counter-Strike, for example, or StarCraft, are about a set of relatively well-understood mechanics. So map navigation, aiming and shooting, micro, which is StarCraft terminology or RTS terminology for how fast you can send build orders, what order you do the build orders in, how quick you can get around the map, and the kind of the very low-level stuff. And then there's a combat strategy, which is called macro in an RTS, which is like the higher level, what you decide to do with your stuff. And these are pretty well understood, and in fact, you can kind of look at this, and this could be Quake, or it could be StarCraft. There's a lot of games that would fit into this set of mechanics, right? At least at this super general level. Obviously, they're totally different games. And I love these games, I want to be totally clear. Counter-Strike is one of my favorite games in the world. I want to have the same level of player skill, but with these mechanics. Behavior perception, subtle performance, playing it cool, the idea that you didn't do something exactly like you wanted to, but where in most games you'd adjust slightly, that will get you shot, so you just play it, you just breathe through it. Social pattern matching. Yeah.
Are you familiar with the restaurant game?
Orkin's game, yeah.
Yeah, I'm wondering, that whole point of the two people playing these two characters.
Right. He's got a new game called, here, let's save that for Q&A, and we can talk about that, yeah, because Jeff's really cool. No, in fact, Jeff came up at PAX East, and we were talking for all because we're friends from the game industry, and we're basically decided we were taking completely opposite approaches to this, right? I'm making the player act like the AI, so I can have the crappiest AI possible. I mean, you know, as I improve the AI, the human will just adjust to whatever the AI technology is, whereas he's doing the opposite, which is trying to mine the player's behavior to generate an awesome AI. Mine is a lot easier to implement. we can talk about that more in Q&A, totally. I want to have this deep level of player skill, but about these things that are much more people skills in some sense. Like, they're obviously, like, kind of the whittled down to their bare skeleton people skills that are expressible through an Xbox 360 controller, but they still are things where your human intuition will help you have an advantage. And in fact, I playtested this this kind of theory. I haven't done it in a very rigorous way, but I had John Romero, who is one of the creators of Doom and id, and his girlfriend Brenda Braithwaite were at IndieCade this summer and or last fall, and so John and Brenda play shooters all the time together, and John wipes the floor with her routinely, and you know, she plays because they're like girlfriend boyfriend, but like, you know, she just gets annihilated all the time. So I had this theory before I realized they were the perfect test candidate for it, which is I had this theory that someone with better people skills would be better than a shooter player who's better at aiming. And so I was like, oh, wait, this is perfect. So I sat them down and had them play, and she wiped the floor with him. Like 10 games, he had no idea what was going on. He's like, why did you shoot me? He's like, you were acting weird. And so it was exactly where I wanted, and that is anecdotal, and the pillar of anecdote is not data, but that is exactly where I wanted to be. And so if I can keep going in that direction, and like I said, Ian and Paul have played for 11 hours, which is sounds like a lot until you realize that people play Counter-Strike for 400 hours, so 11 is nothing compared to the depth of some of these games. So if I can keep that going for that long, that would be really awesome, if it can really be that deep of a player skills esport level thing with these kinds of very different game mechanics. And I think that, like, getting back to getting into that, you know, basically proving Roger Ebert wrong, it seems like there's really two approaches to this, to getting emotional depth. And I think emotional depth is what we're really missing. We do some emotions very well, frustration, power fantasy, the things like that, but we don't do a much wider swath of emotions that the other art and entertainment forms do. And I don't think, again, I don't think it's going to be the same. Like, music does not affect you the same way film does, yet both of them are very deep and meaningful to people, right? So I don't think we're going to be as different emotionally as music is from film and books. We're not going to be like movies, and that's okay, which is why I think that this way is the wrong way to do it. A lot of people think it's a top-down thing. You play games nowadays that are the kind of these theme park ride games where they start with a linear story and then they add interactivity into it. And it basically feels like you're getting this linear narrative doled out to you if you complete an action sequence successfully. So the interactivity is not remotely affecting the story. Maybe it branches a couple times and things like that, but it's very coarse. It seems very difficult to add deep and meaningful interactivity into a pre-existing narrative, linear, top-down, emotionally compelling story. In some sense, there are some theories that they basically act antagonistically, in fact. I think this is a better way to do it. basically, you start with a known good, known compelling interactions and build on interactions to make them emotionally deep. That's kind of the direction I'm trying to take with Spy Party. I don't think I'm going to hit, Les Mis levels of emotional depth, but I think I'm practicing, basically, baby steps again, of doing things that are closer to what you might want to do to make a game like that has that level of emotional depth. Doug Church, who's a Looking Glass game designer from Looking Glass, did games like Ultima Underworld and System Shock and Thief, said this really interesting thing when he was talking about interactive storytelling one time, that basically 5 seconds of Quake is a better interactive story than the entire game of Myst. Because everyone who played Myst played the exact same story, right? There was no interactivity in the story, whereas everyone who plays 5 seconds of Quake has a completely personal experience. Like, I came around the corner with a rocket launcher and I jumped and then and it's exactly custom tailored. It was dynamically generated. We have no idea how to extend that 5 seconds into 30 seconds or a minute or 5 minutes or an hour, but at least that 5 seconds is truly interactive right now, and That's really important. Will used to talk about The Sims in a similar way, which is like The Sims on purpose did not have any narrative arc placed on top of it, and so people could actually spin their own narrative by playing the game. And an advance that he wanted to make that he never got a chance to do or yet was to have the game try and detect that you're doing that kind of thing and help you. You're telling a story about Halloween. Let me start playing some scary music without you having to go select it from the drop-down box. Things like that. You could see that kind of thing working. It's very hard to see how to take a Halloween movie and add interactivity into it and have it not feel like it's a Halloween movie that I'm hitting the A button to click through. Long term, I hope for my Spy Party work, I hope to get to something like this. This is The Party, which is a deeply offensive movie by Peter Sellers. I don't know why they didn't hire an Indian guy to play the Indian guy, but they instead put blackface on Peter Sellers. It makes no sense. But anyway, this is a great screenshot, and the movie is really inspirational from a like set piece thing. It's set in this Hollywood mansion in the 60s, and he walks around making an idiot of himself like every Peter Sellers movie. But you just look at these people's expressions, and there's just so much conveyed in this. Like, there's him being a bumbling idiot. There's the women being surprised that he's so socially awkward. There's the guys being slightly offended. Just the angle of the cigarette, all of these things. And, like, none of these things are that hard. I mean, obviously rendering something this well is a problem, but you can caricature this stuff. I mean, it's already caricatured. But you could see going this direction, these subtleties and things like this, that I think is the direction that games in some sense need to go to really appeal to people. Because people like people. People respond to other people. And so that's my talk. Thank you. So we do Q&A and then set up playtest. All right, so who wants to, while we do Q&A, I brought some manuals for you guys to read. You thought I was kidding. No, you can't play the game if you don't read the manual. Who wants to read the manual?
Quickly, or run into the
right, so I actually, so I do that. I do observe people playing and make the AI, I try and give the AI the same kind of error profile that people have. So for example, I have the AI adjust occasionally, very rarely, just so you can't shoot somebody just for adjusting, right? Here's the level of depth that the game's currently at. My really good, so you notice, I don't know if you noticed, but the ambassador has a personal space simulation going on, right? So, I didn't give any over here, so if you want to take them over. The ambassador doesn't like people being in her personal space, his or her personal space, right? So if you stand too near the ambassador for too long, she or she will bug out and walk away. They'll put the book back, they'll do whatever, they're finish up what they're doing and walk away. My elite sniper playtester noticed that while he noticed that the code was only having the ambassador bug out when the spy was near them. They would never do that when an NPC was near them. So he started, anytime he'd see the ambassador cancel what they were doing and walk away, he's like, okay, then one of those two people must be the spy near them. So I had to actually go add the code and clean that up and make it general. So anybody who's near the ambassador now scares the ambassador away if they're too near for too long. Things like that, I am constantly trying to kind of comb those things out so that it's possible. It needs to always be possible for the spy to act exactly like an NPC at all times. So I that's the baseline rule, right? And then, it's a lot of tuning to decide how visible the tells are, whether they're behavioral versus, so for example, like I added drinks in and, there's gonna be a poison the drink mission. It's not in yet, but the drinks are there and you can take a drink from the waiter and like, drink it. It takes three drinks to drink a wait drink. So it was a tell when someone was slamming a drink at the beginning, because you randomly spawn with a drink. And if you spawn with a drink, you can't do some of the stuff on the side that the hand is holding a drink. So, okay, it's a tell. So now you can look for somebody slamming a drink at the beginning, and it's more than likely the spy who got unluckily spawned with a drink. Things like that. There's a million little things like that just happen magically, but just by putting this human scale interactions in games, that just, it's just laying all over the floor, basically. So, yes?
I guess it's, question about this pamphlet.
So the pamphlet. The funny thing about the pamphlet is, I don't know how many of you know anything about typesetting, but there's body faces and display faces, right? And so, display faces are things for headlines and things, and body faces are what you're supposed to set bulk type in that you read. But I use the display face for the body text because it allowed me to get 20% more words on the page. But here's the funny thing, then I recently read a psych report that said that hard to read display face text is memorized better than like Times or Arial, you know, or Helvetica. So maybe it's an advantage. Anyway, sorry, go on.
Because you talk so much about visuals and aesthetics and things like that.
When I say aesthetics, I mean the design, gameplay aesthetics. Right.
I guess I was a little surprised at both the emphasis you place on the player must having to read this pamphlet and your lack of sort of discussion or articulation of the link and emphasis you place on this writing thing. And then this game.
Yeah, I mean, the truth of the matter is, this is my way I'm able to do depth-first accessibility later. Like, I can only do that because I can force someone to read this manual, right?
Okay.
Like, because if you don't have a manual, if you don't have, like, this is the shortcut for me sitting there. I mean, what used to happen is I would sit there and teach you how to play the game for 10 minutes, right? But then I have no voice after three times of that. So if they're at a trade show, I was like, what am I going to do? I can't do this all day, 8 hours a day. So,
right,
hey.
I guess it's an odd question, but I guess that basically your game players really access, you know, because like in the common media they say, oh, you know, like sort of games, sort of they are, you know, have these emphasize these certain features. But I mean, here you're basically saying that your game players are really going to pick up the game by first mediating through it through this sort of literature.
Well, so this is temporary, right? The game is not going to ship with this giant manual. But for now, yeah, you have to learn how to play it first. It's just like, I mean, you know, if I gave you a deck of cards and told you to play, you know, Texas Hold'em, like, you can't. Like, there's a lot of rules, and there's a lot of things that aren't even mentioned in the rules that are important and things like that. So if you're trying to make a deep game like that, the only way I could figure out to do the depth first accessibility later thing is to actually provide some shortcut, and the written word is the shortcut for right now, right? So I still end up talking to people while they're playing, like things like, you know, I mean, basically, people will read this in line and then get up there and start playing, and you still have to describe the game to them in a lot of ways. Which is one of the reasons I actually have people do that practice spy. You saw both of them go through practicing the spy first, because practicing the sniper is actually mostly just a visual input thing, right? Like, you, by standing in line watching someone play the game, you're getting spy practice. But the actual when to hit the A button, when to hit the B button, how to move your camera, that spy practice thing is actually in your hands, and so you need to actually like do it once to actually even get a feel for it. So that's why I've switched my testing methodology even in the past couple of weeks to having people practice in that way, and I'll probably change it up again. Yeah, it'll be a while before I mean, there will eventually be a playtest where I'm sit people down and don't give them a manual and see what happens, but there's an infinite amount of work between now and then, and I want to spend almost all the work on the depth first. Back there, yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned that all the art is placeholder art.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it seems like adding a higher level of visual detail will make the game more challenging for the sniper. So I guess my question is, at what point do you bring on an artist to do some quote-unquote real art?
Right.
So you can get a feel for how the game is with the actual art in place.
Well, I mean, if you're asking for a date, sometime hopefully in the next few months. But I think that actually I think that it's not actually true that it will make it harder for the sniper. If the art style is art directed correctly, like if it'll be stylish, I'm not going to go for like Heavy Rain, Uncanny Valley craziness, because that's just, I mean, there's no way an indie game could even do that, and it looks like crap even with 100 people working on it, in my opinion. I mean, people are going crazy about L.A. Noire, which is this new Rockstar game, which has this facial capture thing, and I still think it looks crappy. Like, it's just look creepy looking. So I'm going to go much more, like, The Incredibles is a really inspirational film for me from an art direction standpoint. So something like that, the TF2 is a great example of that, interactively speaking. I don't think it will actually make it harder for the sniper, but I'll have to playtest to find out. I think what will happen is, as the animations become smoother and stuff, the game will lift to more behavioral stuff, because right now you can look for glitches and still sometimes nail the guy, whereas if there's way fewer glitches, it will make you pay more attention to like which character has more intentionality. That person went straight from the statues to the bookshelf to the ambassador. That's a tell, right? And I want the game to be more about that behavioral level tell. I still want there to be hard tells, hard animation tells, like that if you catch it, you know, you're screwed. But for the most part, I want a lot of the behavioral stuff to dominate. So for an interesting example of that was totally non-intuitive, you probably didn't notice, but there's the, I think you were playing it, but when a lot of the spy actions now have what I call action tests, which is a basically a clone of the Gears of War active reload thing. Basically, you're allowed to ignore it completely, in which case you do the normal thing. Like, so if it's a bug ambassador, you just do the normal tell. Well, that's a bad example because I don't have one on that. But if you're pulling the microfilm out of the book, if you do a normal or you ignore this little slight tiny little mini game thing at the bottom, sort of mini game's a bad word, but you just do the normal amount of animation tell. If you opt into it, you can do a good job, in which case it's a much faster, smaller tell, so it's harder to see. Or if you screw it up, like the person like takes the bug and they like pat around, and they can't find the bug, and like you know they do that kind of thing. So like it's much harder. So it's kind of this like risk cliff. You opt in and then you have to actually hit it, right? And I thought, and everyone else thought, like, oh, that's going to make the game a little more twitchy, which is not the direction I want the game to go. But I really wanted a way for elite spies to be able to beat middling snipers, even if they're looking right at them, right? But what actually ended up happening was amazing, because I set it down in front of Paul and Ian, and the very existence of perfect action tests, meaning the fact that the tell was way harder to see, made Ian play only the behavioral game. He stopped looking for tells at all. The hard tell. So it lifted the game totally to behavior, which is completely opposite of what everybody thought was going to happen. So like, it's just really nonlinear what goes on when you've got all this stuff. So I'm not sure that the art style will have the, I'm trying not to have too much of an opinion on what I think it's going to do because I was wrong before. So, I mean, we'll just see. Right. So what I do there is the fundamental rule number one is everybody has to go through, you know, it has to be possible to always act the same. And so what happens is the spy's control system and the NPC's controllers go through the same pathing system at the low level. So it's possible to act exactly like them from a walking standpoint and when you trigger the animations and things. I do have to add certain things in. Like when you pick the statue up, it has like three different poses. It's like, and then like, and then like an idle. And I have it go to a 1 second idle in between every kind of stylized pose. That way, when the spy wants to put the statue back, they can do it during the 1 second idle, and it blends properly. So I have to take care to make it possible to always do it, but it becomes a part of like a performance thing, right? And so part of the spy is learning how to perform like the AI, is learning how to walk like them. As long as I can make it possible at the lowest level to do it, then it becomes a player skill thing on the spy's part, which is a good thing, not a bad thing, right? I used to have actually click to move on the mouse keyboard interface, thinking, oh, this is another example like the action test thing. I thought click to move would be better because now you're not having to worry about navigation, right? Click to move meaning like the Sims, like you click over there, the dudes walk. I know I want to eventually have it on consoles, so I was like, click to move interfaces are really bad on consoles. Like the Sims really sucks. Like what am I going to do? And I was like, I'm going to put direct control in. And my theory was, when you're playing a shooter or any kind of direct control game, you don't actually think about movement after you've initially gotten over the initial control system, right? You just kind of move. You just express yourself through the controller. Like, it's one of the places where games are good. This is why things like Kinect and things actually add a barrier there, as opposed to this, which is like a crisp control system. When you're strafing, you know, you go like, I'm going to strafe around this corner. You don't think I'm going to now strafe 3 feet to the left and go forward. You just like go around the corner because it's in your fingers at that point. But that actually makes you closer to the game. That fact that you can express yourself kind of like kinesthetically in the game is better than if you said strafe left, because that makes it symbology and then goes back. So when I added direct control in, it actually got better. It became more like puppeteering your spy, at less like, it became more like being the spy and less like, let me tell the spy where to go. And so to the point where I'm direct control on mouse keyboard too. Like I took click to move out because it's just better to have it be walk around, do what you want. Yeah. Right. So what I tend to do at public play tests is I slowly build in things that test different theories about like how much do you need to be able to see the other person. So for example, so people early on got shot because they were too loud with the controllers until somebody started going like, so one guy like left the AI control on and just jacked the camera stick every time one of the NPCs would move and got that person shot, right? And so, once that got into the mix, it was like, all right, now I don't know if I can listen to the controller or not. So like, then it starts to like, there's this concept of Yomi, which is this, Dave Serlin kind of came up with this concept of, basically the hell, like, you know, I know you something and you know I know something and I know that you know that I know something. And you know, it's kind of like, you know, a thing that goes on. And so there's a lot of that going on with spy choice and all those kinds of things. At PAX, in last fall, I tested, it turned out to be a good test for whether or not you need to be in the same room because A, trade shows are really loud, So you couldn't hear anything from the other person. And the monitors, you were sitting down and the monitor was like this. You couldn't see the other person at all. So it was basically like being over a network connection and people still had a good time. So I was relieved that, no, you don't have to be able to see each other like in that slide. Still, you're going to have voice chat. Yeah, and there's like, I mean, I've gotten shot over voice chat before, you know, over Skype when you hear me click, kind of, you know, like there's a lot of subtleties going on there, but I think the game will work out. The bigger problem, actually, from the design of the game is you can't have two people playing on the same couch in front of a, you know, because like, so I got to figure out what to do about that. But I think that like I'm kind of working that stuff in on the side a little bit, but I'm still focusing mostly on the depth. Once I get the game depth to where I want it to be, which I'm not exactly sure how I'll know that, but it's not that far away in terms of features. Like it might be far away in terms of calendar months, but so here's an example of something I want to add. Like there's a security guy in the back, right? I eventually want the sniper to be able to tell the security guard to go interrogate someone, right? And so you basically highlight somebody and say, you know, push a button, and the security guard will walk over and do a little branching conversation tree with that person. They'll pull them aside. Excuse me, can I talk to you, miss? And they'll do a little thing like, how's your dog Fluffy, from the dossier of the person. You know, just a little tag system, just super easy. And so you need to know whether that you have a dog Fluffy or whether that's not, you know, I don't have a dog Fluffy, what are you talking about? Or, oh, she's great, right? But the spy will have to be able to answer correctly, but the sniper will also have to know from the dossier, because it's not going to, the sniper's not asking the question, they're just telling the guy. But the spy can actually choose to be the security guard. So now you're getting commands from the spy to go, like, talk to somebody, and you bug the ambassador on the way by. So now the sniper can't even trust their own security guard. And so I want to do, like, so there's a few more, like, features that are, like, you know, just, you know, it's elephants all the way down kind of thing. And so, and then we'll see where we are. And then eventually, I mean, at some point I have to start working on accessibility. And, I mean, it plays over the internet right now, but it's just really clunky. So, yeah, eventually I'll have to do that if I'm ever going to ship it. Yes. Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of the great things about spy fiction as a thing is that it's about quote unquote normal people, right? You can mostly, like, they're not like in space battle armor and they're not orcs, right? I mean, that's a huge, I mean, the fact that they're not space aliens or orcs is a giant step right there, right? But, so the fact that it's dorky, I mean, you know, you, like, so spies are mostly normal, certainly the people at the party are caricatures, but normal people, but you can pretty much get away with anything. You can, like, kind of rationalize anything. Like, why are you picking up the precious statues at this party? That makes no sense whatsoever. But it's a spy movie. Who cares, right? Like, you know, I mean, you can get away with a lot. So it's kind of a very flexible, like, foundation on which to build this stuff. So it allows me to get to the human scale stuff without having to write. Like, I gave a talk at GDC this year where I was talking about, like, if you think about Seinfeld and Friends as two TV shows, like, they're totally different TV shows. No one would say they were the same TV show, but yet, if you express them both in the only game that they were expressible in, which is The Sims, they're exactly the same show, right? There's a bunch of good-looking people in New York, right? Like, in an apartment. Like, there's no difference. We don't know how to make the difference between Seinfeld and Friends interactively yet, so it would be great to do a sitcom as a game, but it's just too hard. Like, there's no... Whereas the spy fiction, this inverse Turing test thing, allows me to experiment with some of that stuff, having a drink, you know, flirting with somebody, that kind of thing, without, like... but have it still have some compelling, like, you know, skill-based gameplay that I can still, you know, there's still a game there. Like, I don't know how to make Seinfeld the game yet, right? So, like, it's too far so far, you know. So spies are kind of the perfect, like, mix of fantasy and mundanity, I think. Yes.
So, when do you start development on this?
Okay. Do you have another question, or is
well,
it just...
I was kind of the answer depends on how I can ask it.
Oh, okay. So I've been on full time. I got laid off from Maxis in September of last year. So I was going to quit anyway and do this, but I was like, okay. So it moved my schedule up for 3 months. So that's a year and a half, basically. And then before that, the idea that came about in like 2004 at Indie Game Jam. We did an Indie Game Jam with the Sims assets about people interacting, basically this idea of these low-level, you know, human-scale interactions. And it turned out to be a really bad idea for Indie Game Jam because it's just really hard in 4 days to do anything about people whatsoever, even with the Sims assets and all the animations. It's just very difficult. So I didn't even get it working, but the germ of the idea happened then. So then I kind of worked on it an hour or two here or there over, you know, for a few years and then went full-time on it last year. So,
okay. So during the development of this, there had been... I think at least one or two, like, not definitely not as deep as
So like the ship in Assassin's Creed Brotherhood?
Those right.
Yes.
Have you been looking at those?
Yeah. So first off, let me explain what you're talking about to other people. So there are a bunch of games, and some games, like The Ship, came out years ago on Steam, and Assassin's Creed, which is a big Ubisoft franchise now, Brotherhood, their latest version, has a multiplayer mode. Both of these games are the college campus game Assassin, basically. So Assassin, for those of you who don't know, is like basically everybody puts their name in a hat, everybody draws out a name, the name you draw is your target, and somebody else got your name. If they kill you, they get your name, they get the name you got, and until it gets to one person, that person won. The thing about those games is that, and they're great, it's a psychology game, right? Like, I want more games like that, not fewer. Like, I'm not worried about competition, I'm worried about, like, anyone even wanting to play a game about psychology, right? So, but the thing about Assassins is it's totally symmetric. Like, I'm hunting you, but I always have to be watching my back, which never allows me to do that good of a job of hunting you, right? Whereas, and you can feel this in The Ship and in Assassin's Creed Brotherhood, where you're constantly getting killed right as you're about to get your guy, right? And in fact, in Brotherhood and in The Ship, you have to kind of uncloak, so to speak, to kill somebody, unless you're using the poison thing, which doesn't come out until level 29, which is like a totally stupid. And I had a bunch of rants about it. I have a big post on it.
No.
Yeah. But the point being is, I want those games to be more about psychology, not less. Like Assassin's Creed Brotherhood, for example, has a radar, so everybody just plays the radar. And it has a radar because it's such a giant city. So like, just make it in a square, smaller, and have, you know, get rid of the radar so people play the psychology game. So I would actually change those games to be, I have a bunch of, like, I'm gonna make a big post about what they should have done to make it more like Spy Party. Not more like Spy Party, but just more. But that asymmetry thing is huge. In Spy Party, the sniper knows the spy can't escape the party and come stab him in the back. So he can just completely relax, and so I can completely overload him with information. Because they're not worried about other things. Their only task is the perception task. Similarly, the spy knows the only thing they can do is perform. Like, they can't, like, run around and then shoot the sniper to win. They can't do any of that. They have to perform within the constraint. So, in some sense, the design forces is kind of the wrong word, because it's just, like, with a design, like, I mean, it's kind of, this, just the what you do in the game is more psychological. And so, so I hope there are more games that mix in more psychology stuff, and I hope they do a better job of it than those games, because I think those games are cool, but they could have been so much better. So. Yeah, well, I want to get the base asymmetric, super asymmetric game in first, you know, 1v1, because it's the most pure thing. Then there's a ton of game modes, like, you know, multiple spies at a party, multiple snipers, spy-sniper teams, some crazy game modes, like, there's this one James Bond film where, I think it was one of the Pierce Brosnan ones, where he's, like, guys chasing him through an art gallery, you know, an opening, right? And then, like, you know, Pierce Brosnan ends up stabbing him with his own knife and then sits him down in a chair to bleed out while he walks away. And so it's a perfect thing of, like, you know, everyone just thinks there's a guy sitting in a chair, and yet, so, like, that's cool, that's more symmetric, right? So at that point, I want to, like, really amp this asymmetry first. But another crazy idea was spy-sniper teams, you know, one spy, one sniper. With teams, you don't know who your spy is, and it's an open chat channel. So it's kind of like Bridge, where you have to, like, kind of communicate somehow that, like, you know. And another one of those is I want to do. I don't think this one will actually get through TRC, but which is the cert process for consoles. But I want to do drop-in, drop-out, where you don't notify the other players that someone dropped in. So, like, one of the characters just becomes a spy, but you don't know this. So, like, there's a ton of stuff, and you just, like, I mean, you could go on all. I got a notebook full of ideas like this. I mean, who knows what I'll end up shipping, but, like. Yeah, I mean, as soon as you start, like, there are maps in there now where one sniper can't see the whole map at the same time. So that's obviously multiple snipers. I mean, it scales arbitrarily on the sniper side, right? It's a party game. Like, you could have five people on the couch playing one sniper. It'd be really hard for the spy at that point, but, like, but you can see it happening. So yeah, there's a bunch of stuff to do there. It's just, I want to get the core, the kind of diamond core of the thing is that 1v1 asymmetric experience. I want to get that first. Who have I not called on? I mean, I think, well, so, as soon as you say the word RPG, it means stats, armor, blah, 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 right? So, like, so do you mean RPG or role-playing game? You see what I'm saying? There's a big difference, right? Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of RPGs nowadays are following that kind of top-down thing. Like, they have a narrative, and you have an adventure in that narrative, and it kind of branches occasionally and things like that, but you're not really affecting what happens. Maybe there's three endings, maybe there's six endings, that kind of thing. And I just think it's a really tough row to hoe. Like, I don't see how you get deep interactivity into that. Now, obviously, the mechanics of the, you know, your loadout of your guy and your party and, like, how you do the fights and things like that are totally interactive. But those don't really talk to the story that much, right? Like, they're pretty separate things. You do those things to notch the story forward, you know? So I just think it's like, those big games like, I mean, Dragon's Age or whatever, you know, the games like that, those games are going to still be around. I think in some sense a dead end for the 50-year time frame, because I just don't see how you add the interactivity in at the deeper levels, like Uncharted 2, things like that. It's what I call theme park ride games, where you know, you're along for the ride, and that's great, and it's fun. Everybody likes theme parks, but I don't see how that gets us out of competing with film and into, you know, interactivity as the forefront interaction. So some slides I cut out of this, there's like, when you're doing fiction, there's like all these characteristics of fiction, right? Like, you know, you just go online or go to a fiction class or whatever. It's like plot, characters, setting, dialogue, mood, all the, you know, there's like 6 or 8 of them, whatever. And it's interesting because games tend to focus almost monomaniacally on plot, which is the least interactive of all of those things. So I'm kind of just, I'm not focusing on plot at all. I'm kind of doing the Left 4 Dead thing, which is just like, you know, the barest, like, it's a zombie invasion. You know, that's all Left 4 Dead's plot, right? Like, and mine is like, there's a party and a spy there. What are you going to do? Like, but I'm totally focusing on characters and setting, right? And it's interesting because, like, you in more mature art forms like literature and film, you can find works that focus on characters only, or plot only, or dialogue only, or mood only. They don't all have really strong plot, whereas in games, it just seems like if you don't have a plot, you're not like a real game, which just confuses me because it's the worst one for interactivity. Like, it's not the most important in fiction. Like, all of those are equal. Like, you can't do a good work of fiction without all of those things to some extent. Why would we focus as an industry on the one that's the hardest one for the core differentiator of our art form? I have no idea. It just seems stupid. We like to fetishize plot for some reason. Oh, it's horrible. I mean, yeah, the people are like, people talk about like Heavy Rain or Uncharted 2 as like a good movie. No, it's not. It's a horrible movie. Judged against movies, they're terrible. I mean, like, the dialogue's terrible, the whole thing's terrible. It's a go-shay shooting game. there was somebody, yes. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of trash talking, so I'm going to have like post-game. I mean, games, there's a lot of like theory and practice around lobbies and how that all works, and like, you know, you have to give people a place after the game where you don't just mix them up into the crowds again. They can decompress like a sport. You know, we talk about it in the locker room afterwards, that kind of thing. So you got to do a ton of that stuff, totally. I mean, obviously, playing head-to-head with the laptops like this is the superior way to play, right? Like, but you can't do that. It doesn't scale. So you have to make it as good as possible with voice chat and, like, you know, post-game analysis stuff, like having the game. Like, right now, you see at the end of the game, I don't know if it's still on there, where it prints out what happened in the game. And I mean, that's all going to be, like, you know, replay videos and stuff. And now here's where the, like, ambassador was bugged, so, and you were looking over here, you know, that kind of thing. And, like, you know, it'll highlight something that happened that you were looking right at where you could have seen that. Or, like, oh, you should have waited until his laser wasn't anywhere near you. He was actually, you know, whatever. So basically, you want to, like, kind of encourage that stuff as much as possible. I also want to do a bunch of mentoring stuff where good players can help bad players get better, which will hopefully re-vector some of the owning noobs problem in online games that they have. So, I don't know. We'll see how it goes. Well, do I? No, I mean, there's a quality problem there, right? But it doesn't actually affect the gameplay. I mean, one of the great things about this game design, I kind of stumbled into the in a lot of ways, but, like, the both players adapt to the crappiness of what's happening. So, like, the characters intersect all the time now, and what ends up happening is the sniper goes, hey, is the spy the only one who'll intersect? And I'm like, nope, everybody intersects. He's like, okay. Like, it's just this thing. I mean, I'm gonna fix it because, like, I have attention to detail and I'm a perfectionist and I don't want things like that, but I don't actually have to. Which is great. It allows me to ship, you know, this is why it's an inverse test instead of a forward Turing test in some sense. Like, it means that I don't have to have perfect AIs. The players will adjust to it.
Well, if your art is really good at that.
Yeah, but those guys, Team Fortress 2 guys, are in apprenticeship all the time. No, but I mean, like, that's part of where and this gets to her question about the spy fiction. Like, it's like, choose your battles, right? And so, like, I'm not writing a love story, and so, like, a little bit of interpenetration is not a big deal. It doesn't, yeah. Totally fired. I walked into that. So, but yeah, but it's like, all right. Sensor on. But it just, I mean, it's amazing how much the players will just adjust to that sort of thing. I mean, you're just used to doing that in games all the time anyway, and so this just, it just provides it's great that the game is robust in the face of that, because I was worried that I would have to hit this quality bar. The game got playable way before I thought it would. So, and that's cool. Like, I mean, yay. I mean, that and to me, that means now, like, okay, we should all be exploring this human scale stuff, because it's just not actually that hard, technically. You don't have to have the perfect animation system to have two people hand each other a drink and have it look compelling enough that it means something. Which is great. I mean, that's huge. Like, if it had to be perfect, like, man, that's an excuse for us not to do it. Now there's not really much of an excuse, in my opinion. Right. Yeah, and humans are really good at just at constructing all of the stuff around. So it's like, and sometimes games, I mean, this is where the Uncanny Valley is what is about the fact that why are you trying to short circuit that and failing, right? It's so stylized art, knowing which things are important to fix and which aren't. Like, it's way more important to have the guy pause for 1 second, a variable amount of time, up to 1 second, before putting the statue away than it is to have the hands be exactly registered. Because one allows the affordance for the player to actually compete with the AIs, the other is just polish, you know. Yes?
Why do you make games?
So it's complicated, but I mean, so that's, I mean, that's like, why do you...
And the explanation can be at least as much historical as it is.
Well, there's, I mean, it's multifaceted. So like, so one, there's the personal thing, like a bunch of the things I want to say seem to be compatible with interactivity. Like, I want to explore things that are, you know, why do you paint, right? Like, oh, because I'm visual or whatever, right? So so there's that's kind of the artist side of it. There's a kind of like kind of historical, like, importance aspect to it, which is that I think that games are in around 1904 relative to film, and it's really exciting to be at the point where no one knows what the hell they're doing and, like, all bets are off. And, like, basically, film was the preeminent art form of the 20th century, right? So, I mean, you know, film's not better than literature and music, but it's clear from the 20th century, like, it was the film century, right? I think that if we don't screw it up, games could be the preeminent art form of the 21st century, art and entertainment form. But we are a long way away from there, and being someone who, you know, and being at the beginning of that, like, somebody's gonna move the camera first, somebody's gonna, like, you know, realize that they can edit the film in a different sequence than they filmed it. Like, those things are, like, it's all sitting there on the floor to pick up right now. Whereas if you go into film, like, you go to NYU Film School for a long time, and then you'd, like, you know, whatever, and you work your way up, and, like, it's just pretty much known. I mean, that's great, and if you want to tell narrative, you know, moving image things, like, film's your thing. And it's great that the barrier to entry is really low. You can get an 8, you know, my camera in my backpack does 720p at 30 frames a second, and it's $150, right? But games are this basically totally new thing, and they have this huge potential, and so I want to help them get there. Yeah. But I think that the more important thing is, like, it's just the interactivity is just so different from the way music works, if literature works, or film works. It's just exciting to work in something that's like, what is the expressive power? And how like, this question that's kind of been going around GDC for a while is, like, how do games mean? Like, art and entertainment is meaningful, like, good art and entertainment. And we don't really know how meaning happens through interactivity yet. And I mean that in the most lit-critty way possible. And so, like, we're going to figure that out over the next 50 years, and that's pretty cool. Well, so when you say comics, there's two things you could mean. You could mean cartoon look, or you could mean 2D, like, you know, do you mean the 2D panel aspect of comics, or do you mean, like, toon shading, basically? Yes, oh, that's totally true. I mean, the Scott McCloudian, like, you know, use abstraction as a power-up as opposed to, like, trying to get rid of it is totally all... That's why I was saying The Incredibles is great. One of the things that's neat about The Incredibles and TF2, to some extent, is, like, what time period are they from? Like, you can't tell. It's totally ambiguous. Like, is it old? Is it new? Is it future? Is it past? Like, so, I want to definitely do that. Like, I don't want to invoke 60s and have it look like, you know, the Avengers, right? Like, that would be the obvious thing to do. Or James Bond, you know, like, you know, Ian Fleming, or Connery era James Bond. Like, but those, I think that would be wrong, because I think that's too specific. So, yeah, you want to use abstraction a lot. You want to use caricature. You want to use, I don't know whether it'll be actually toon shaded, because that's got kind of like a stigma at this point. But, like, yeah, total caricaturization and abstraction, for sure. And both by choice and by necessity. Like, I couldn't do realism if I wanted to. Like, it's just that, like, you need hundreds of people to even suck at it. Yeah. But I wouldn't want to. So, like, yeah. It's even... It's because I tune the game. I play the shit out of it. No, it's like, I haven't actually run the PAX numbers yet, but I very much try and keep it even, basically. So, there's two ways, there's four outcomes for the game, one of which needs to change. There's sniper shoots the right guy, that's awesome, yeah, right? Everyone feels great. Even the spy's like, oh, God, you got me, right? There's sniper shoots the wrong guy, everybody feels great. It's like, ha ha, you shot the wrong guy, ah, damn, you know? There's spy accomplishes the mission. Sniper's like, what the fuck? And spy's like, haha, I'm awesome. Those are all satisfying outcomes, right? And so, I can't remember the exact specifics, but, the one that's not satisfying is spy runs out of time. which is just kind of boring, right? Like, it's boring for both people. It's like, I couldn't figure out who it was. Oh, it's because you didn't accomplish all the missions. So now, the new idea there, which I haven't implemented yet, is, like, have people start leaving the room. So instead of having the game end at the timer, like, everyone just starts filing out of the room. So you can try and accomplish some missions before you file out of the room, but, like, you're really a suspect at that point, right? So, so I don't know. We'll see how that goes. I mean, I have no idea how that's going to work. But, but right now, if you take Spy Shoots the Wrong Guy, Sniper shoots the wrong guy and Spy accomplishes the mission versus Sniper shoots the right guy, Spy runs out of time there even. Or, you know, 49, 51, you know, depends on the day of the week, right? But that's about even. So that's where I want it to be. That's for noobs, and at the high end, Sniper has a slight advantage right now. But we think the current theory is because Ian helped out at PAX and got basically 30 hours of Sniper practice. So I don't actually know whether the game's unbalanced, or he's just that much better now. Because he can kill me now, he's better than I am now as a sniper and a spy. So I need to, after I'm done with my series of lectures this month and everything, like, the current thing is to figure out, is it unbalanced at that extreme level, or is it just he's that much better and Paul and I have to catch up, basically. So. Yes?
Well, I don't know what the other people in the audience thought, but when I was watching it, like, just as a spectator, I was much more interested in the snipers.
Well, you're playing the sniper, right? When you're watching the sniper, you can play the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, whereas the spy, you can't, right? The spy, you're just watching some guy play a video game. Okay. And people find it interesting to watch the sniper if they know, or to watch the spy if they know they're going to play, because they're watching for the tells, and they want to see what it looks like. So if you're gearing yourself up for going to play, then it's interesting. But for the most part, yeah, the sniper, watching the sniper is a game, right? Like, who is it? I don't know who it is. So, like, in fact, you could easily imagine kind of spectator modes where the spectators can all, like, decide who they think it is, and then when the game's over, they go, oh, yeah, you got it right, or you didn't. So it's in some sense scales in that way. Yeah. Yeah, there's this idea of, in game design, there's this idea of credit and blame assignment. Like, you need to be able to, if you die, you need to know that you did it wrong and why.
How are you doing that?
Yeah, I mean, that's just that. Like, when you get shot, what often happens in person is someone's like, oh, why'd you shoot me? Oh, because I saw you bug the ambassador, right? You saw them talking about that earlier. What I'm going to do is point out where the cameras were and what was, you know, basically show what he saw when he decided to shoot you. Yeah.
And how
Well, then, I mean, at some level, you know you were doing a good job at that point, right? So if the sniper shoots the wrong person, well, the sniper is going to see replays of, like, here's what you missed. This person was at the bookshelf. Here's where they were at the thing. Here's a playback of what happened, that kind of thing. Plus, I really want to encourage people to be civil and discuss it, right? I mean, whether that's going to work or not, I don't know. But it's a very different game, right? It's a very different game from a, like, testosterone-addled, like, shooter, right? And so you come off of it, like, stressed, not amped, right? And so I'm hoping that'll help. I don't know. We'll see. It remains to be seen. Yeah?
General question about this notion of the future of video games and finding our Citizen Kane, that sort
right.
of thing.
For the record, Casablanca is a better movie than Citizen Kane. But anyway,
I have a lot of time for that. So what? I would say genres, but genres are kind of the dying term, and now it's this sort of non-versatilian category. This is tagged as this trope. What sorts of trends do you think need to die out and go away, and what trends do you think we need to start fleshing out, and what trends do you think there will be in the future in finding that sort of holy grail?
Well, I think that, like, I mean, it's not gonna be the holy grail where you find it. Like, we're gonna work our asses off and hopefully cross a threshold at some point. But I mean, like, there's so many, I mean, it's a really complicated question, right? And I don't even know if I know the answers.
So,
I mean, I don't even know if I know my opinions, but I think that, like, in some senses, there's this vicious cycle right now of developers, press, and fans that just kind of feed on each other, and this is where you get the, like, if I don't do the press release about the 40 new weapons in my game, you know, so this is like, and then the fans are asking for it, and, like, so it's this kind of, like, that takes us down a rat hole, which is not healthy for the medium, right?
So this is kind of relevant to, I don't know who of Blizzard said it, but they said basically, we're going to keep developing for a while, but we cannot move forward unless we do a new one.
Right, well, I mean, on a per-project basis, clearly you get this, like, I've got a big, it's a boat and it's hard to steer after a certain point, you know, I mean, like, I, I used to work at Microsoft, and it's like, you know, doing anything in Windows, it's like, you know, it's like just, I mean, anything with that much compatibility and people using it and everything like that, it's just like, so yeah, you have to do new projects, that's for sure. But I think that, I mean, I think your question is more interesting across the whole, which is just like, yeah, there's all these dynamics that are just not healthy for us. I mean, and sometimes there's too much money in the industry. I mean, that, we're kind of in a golden age of indie right now, which is great. So, meaning XBLA, PSN, Steam, Minecraft showing, you know, the way certain things can work out. There's a lot of experimentation going on, and that's great. It needs to happen at the higher level, at the AAA level as well, though. So that's why I think AC Brotherhood is great. I mean, I'm happy. I wish they'd, like, make it more. I think that, like, yeah, the genrefications problem, like the way the, you know, the way the press releases work and all that stuff. I mean, it's a huge problem, and the only solution, and since you can't change any of that stuff in some sense, like the only solution is just try and make interesting games. Even if it's just like something like the eco handholding thing, like just put something like that in your game and move it forward. Just, you know, move the ball forward a yard or whatever each time. And I think that we'll eventually get there. I hope that we don't get ghettoized permanently like comics did first. You know, I mean, comics in some sense, it was too far gone when Mouse came out, you know, like Mouse came out and Chris Ware and all these things, and like, yeah, those are amazing, Pulitzer Prize winning, amazing things, but it didn't pull comics out of the superhero ghetto. So it can be too late, and I just hope it's not for us. I mean, we make way more money and we're way more mass market than they are, so hopefully that's a little bit of insulation, but we certainly don't seem to be trying that hard in a lot of ways. Yeah. Yes, last question, and then we'll...
You mentioned all the things that Clark argues in the beginning, but it focuses on behavior, perception, et cetera. Is it possible to make an interesting single-player game that uses the same aspects of the brain?
The answer, like, I have to make a single-player Spy Party just from a financial standpoint. Like, shipping a multiplayer-only indie game is a death sentence, so I'm going to figure it out. I did a big brainstorming session with a bunch of other designers, and I took 12 pages of notes, and so I've got a bunch of ideas about what to try. There's basically three hierarchical... There's basically tutorial, obviously has to have a tutorial, so I don't have this anymore, right? There's practice, which is not tutorial. Practice is for expert or good players to get better, right? It's like you go to goproblems.com or whatever, and like it's a great way to like just practice more, you know, chess problems, any kind of thing like that. It's a way for you to practice without logging on. And then there's like campaign, which is like StarCraft 2, right? Where it's like StarCraft 2 campaign is totally different from StarCraft 2 multiplayer. Like there's different units and everything, right? But it tastes like the same game. It feels like it's part of the whole thing. That would be great. It's a lot of work to do that. So I'm at least going to have tutorial and practice, and hopefully I can come up with some kind of campaign. Spy, I think, like, getting, one big problem is what does it feel like to get shot by an AI sniper? And it probably doesn't feel very good, right? And so I'm gonna have to, like, I'm gonna have to solve some of those problems. Dave Serlin pointed out that Chessmaster had a great solution for that, which is that instead of you just dialing the AI from 1 to 10, they had personalities, so you could play a monkey or you could play Kasparov. And so when Kasparov kicked your ass, like, it wasn't a big deal. And so, like, that idea of adding personalities on top of the AI is cool. So, like, you're playing the enemy at the gates sniper guy when he shoots you in the head in 20 seconds. Like, hey, he's the Studley sniper guy. So I might work on some of that stuff. We'll see. I don't know. All right, should we play test? Who wants to play?